full from our wonderful lunch. Welcome to session 4, which is the Startup Farm and Garden Stories panel. My name is Claire Fox, and I will be the moderator for this hour. I would like you to please turn off or silence your cell phones, and please reserve your questions for the end of the panel discussion when we will have a brief Q&A session. Before we begin, Jen Halpin of the Dickinson College Farm will give us a brief background on the motivation behind creating this panel. Jen?
So welcome, everybody. Really, the premise of this panel discussion is to answer a lot of questions that come my way, I'm sure, Chase's way, and Dan's way, and the Dillman Hills way, like, how did you get started? And this is really to provide a forum for that kind of information exchange of startup stories so as to help maybe direct or start the motivation and momentum at your particular institution. And the goal is also to really leave time at the end for questions and answers, because there might be questions that you have in your head that we aren't addressing here. And I will say that the questions that we are addressing were brought up by students, what students thought would be really interesting to learn more about from other institutional perspectives. So I tried to capture that interest as much as possible, but I may not have done it to its complete possibility, so that's why I want to leave some room for Q&A. But so that's why we're here, and definitely interested in having that sharing going on. Super.
All right, thank you. Next, I will present each of the panelists, and each member will give a brief background of their work. So first, we have Elizabeth Goodwin from Cornell University.
I've been a manager at the student farm for the past 2 seasons. Dillman Hill is has 12 acres of land. Only 1.5, I think, are we're actually producing food with. It was first established in 1996, but there have been a lot of changes since, which I guess we'll get into in the panel.
Next, we have Jen Halpin from the Dickinson College Farm.
Hello again. I'm the farm manager, and the main objectives for our farm are production and education. That's our main focus, with a splattering of renewable energy as well.
Thanks. Next, we have Chase Hubbard from Warren Wilson College.
The farm manager at Warren Wilson College. We started as Asheville Farm School back in 1894, and we have a work program, so one of the work colleges, and so about 28 students work on our crew. It's a crop and livestock operation, focused on sustainable agriculture and local food.
And finally, we have Dan Webster representing Messiah.
Save the Webster jokes for later. I am the Sustainability Projects Coordinator at Dickinson, but I was the co-manager of the Grant Community Garden at Messiah College as an undergrad for 3 years. And our main focus was production and education there, and it's a 1/4-acre space.
All right, thank you. Our first question for the panelists is, what is a manageable startup scenario in terms of lands, fund, personnel?
I guess to answer that, I'll just sort of briefly describe our startup scenario at Cornell. In 1996, there was a group of faculty and staff and students, and they were called the Sustainable Ag Working Group. And they worked with the administration to secure 2 acres of land that was owned by Cornell Orchards. Cornell has research orchards really close to campus, and they weren't using them for orchards anymore. So this working group worked with the administration to secure that land, and also applied for grants. I think we'll be talking more about finances later. And then 2 years later, the property directly adjacent to the 2 acres that they had got, they worked with, that was owned by Animal Science. So they got an additional, what was it, additional 10 acres from Animal Science right next to the property that they had, and then got access to a barn. So I guess feasible startup scenario is a relationship with faculty and staff, student relationship with faculty and staff who have interest in sustainability and student farming and student empowerment, so that you have, you know, kind of more leverage when you're working with administration to secure land nearby another startup space that hopefully there is available nearby. And access to funding, whether through grants or through generous alumni or faculty or whatever.
The College Farm actually started out of a student garden program that in its at the end of its time was 3/4 acres in size. It actually started out as 2 100-square-foot beds, and it was started within the Environmental Studies Department. It was completely student-started and student-run for the first 3 years of its existence. And then in 2002, the Environmental Studies Department applied for an internal funding, a grant called Innovation Grants that Dickinson College grants to innovative ideas from faculty and departments on campus. And that enabled the Environmental Studies Department to hire a quarter-time coordinator, and that was me. So I worked 8 hours a week from 2002 to 2004, and then that increased to half-time, so 20 hours a week, and then to full-time in 2007. We basically proposed the idea to the college to consider the possibility of transferring the venue of the student garden to a farm scenario based on the momentum that was being generated on campus. And the land was actually owned by the college. It was bequeathed to the farm, I mean to the college in the 1960s by a graduate. And under one of the stipulations of this donation was that it could only stay in agricultural use. So it was an idea that came, I think, at the right time. It was before the economy kind of hit the bucket. So we were able to transition the garden to the farm venue. And that was done with proof of a 5-year business plan that we presented to the college administration, showing them where we saw revenue and where we saw expenses and how we'd make up the difference. So
being an older farm program, I'm probably not the best person to talk about startup. However, you know, I think all of our programs evolve over time, you know, what they were before, not necessarily what they are now. So we certainly had to make changes and do some of these same kind of things, leverage resources, get grants, make connections to make it happen. Our organic garden at the college is probably a great example. Back in the 1980s, that land was given by the production agriculture component to do this organic garden. And you know how these dynamics can be sometimes. But that's turned out to be an exceptional program. You know, it's similar to what you guys, vegetable production and flowers, and it's just a beautiful space on campus. I think in general it really takes some strong leadership, people that really have a vision and can articulate that vision to the community and talk about all the different things it can do for the college.
Yeah, and the Grand Community Garden was very much a venture, so we're still in very much startup scenario phase, even though we've been a part of the campus for 4 years. But our main priority was finding a visible space on the campus for the community garden space. Particularly to Messiah College, because we didn't have the type of sustainability initiative necessarily that Dickinson and Warren Wilson, that kind of history. So we really wanted this to be a visible spot on campus, and it is between an academic building and a residential hall, a quarter-acre space for thousands of people passing that garden by daily. So land, visible land to campus and both admissions tours was very important going into our business plan. Personnel-wise, we knew we needed a dream team because it was all student-led and student-inspired. So we needed a very strong PR person. I was not that person. I was more of the strategic development side, business plan. I sort of played bad cop or instigator in a lot of those meetings. But my best friend was a very gracious PR person, working with VPs, working with President's Cabinet, folks like David Foster, who's sitting up here, who's the faculty advisor for the garden. And so we needed a lot of students to begin. So we marched into the VP's office for our first meeting, and we had 15 students there. They thought we were only bringing 3, but I decided we needed a few more troops for that meeting. So personnel, we need a lot of volunteers to begin. Funds. We knew we wanted to start this community garden fast. We wanted very much a sustainability landmark on campus. Student Government Association, as some of you know, is sometimes a difficult sell if you want to get things done quickly. So we were fortunate enough to have a community service center, the Agape Center on campus, that had a sustainable ag section. They took they take volunteers from Messiah College into Harrisburg to an urban farm weekly at the Joshua Farm. And Kirsten Renford has been floating around. She's a farm manager at the Joshua Farm. And so they had extra funds available. And so we made a very meager budget of about $1,000. And we sent it to the Agape Center, and they were more than happy to start us up. We also had in mind that in the future, we would be a self-sufficient organization. So we wanted to try a model that we would be the first student organization on campus that didn't need funds from internal sources at Messiah. And we've gotten to that point with our CSA program.
All right, thank you very much. And elaborating on Dan's comment about the visibility being important, how does the garden or the farm's proximity to campus play a role in its success? For example, the Dickinson College Farm is about 7 miles away, actually from campus, whereas the Messiah College student farm is right in the middle of campus. So I'd like to pose that question to the panelists.
I think visibility is definitely important. Students in particular have busy schedules, and fitting in perhaps a couple hours to go, maybe 7 miles for you guys, for us, it's I think just like a quarter mile away from campus can sometimes be a lot to ask. So we are not right on campus, but we are on campus. The farm is like a 10-minute walk from the Ag Quad. There are several quads in Cornell, and it's farther from the Arts Quad, where there are a lot of more like liberal arts students, and probably about the same from the Engineering Quad. So it's close proximity to the students who are most likely to come out, people who are studying agriculture and life sciences, but kind of more farther away from people who, might think that they have a place to be like this, which is not true. But so we try to bring more to campus. So our farm stands that we have twice a week are on campus, and they're on the Ag Quad, where, the library and a lot of the classes in life sciences are held. And then there's another one on a plaza that's closer to the arts students and engineering students, and where there's a lot of traffic. So there's that. There are the market stands. And in addition, we just try to get to as many on-campus events as possible so that people know that it exists and then will come out. Because it's not that far away, but people aren't passing by it every day. So we try to sort of bring ourselves to campus in order to bring people out to the farm.
So starting as Asheville Farm School, our farm really is the campus. And when you drive into our campus, you come from an area that's fairly developed, and it opens up into this oasis, this agricultural oasis that's just... it's incredible. I'm still awe-inspired after, almost 20 years of being involved in agriculture there and the farm manager for 12. I sort of never tire of how incredible our landscape is, the Swannanoa Valley, the river, the mountains. And so it's a huge part. The college leverages that as a part of our marketing. For students have no interest in agriculture, or, very little, not... besides the fact that open space creates a nice place to hang out, study, or throw a frisbee or whatever else. But also for faculty, just as a quality of life thing. The farm and the gardens are a huge part of who we are and a big part of our identity. And so our big marketing committee and admissions, they really like to feature pictures of students working in farm environments and really just highlighting that kind of stuff.
I'll just address the distance, because it sounds like the three other panelists have a closer proximity. We are 7 miles from campus, and what we do is we try to bring the farm to campus as much as possible and then work very actively with faculty and students to create opportunities for them both academically and recreationally at the farm. That includes a weekly wheat and feed, volunteer days every Friday. We actually transport students out to the farm and back. That's actually another opportunity for students to come out. Students whose schedules don't align with our lead and feed on Fridays can actually contact us, and we'll schedule them to come out with a student farmer. We have two vehicles designated for the farm, a truck and a minivan, so that transports students out. And we have awesome students who like to bike out as well. So it's a very bikeable ride from Carlisle. But we do try to have things on campus to help bridge that spatial distance. That's in the form of the Harvest Fest that we have, our local food dinner. We have a weekly farm stand in the fall semester. And we try to work with Res Life, Residential Life, to bring programming from residence halls to the farm. So it's an active dialogue back and forth. And one of the successes we've had is working with faculty, especially with first-year seminars. It's a mandatory course that first-year students have to take at Dickinson. And last year, in particular, there were seven first-year seminars focused on the topic of food. And so we were able to integrate directly with those courses, having community service hours required of those students, having events out of the farm that were geared towards processing chickens or watching a film, just kind of giving them that hands-on opportunity. So it's just important to, you know, try to play with all the allies that you have when the distance is an issue.
Yeah, I think being so visible can have its pros and cons too. I mean, yes, we got a lot of visibility, but we also have board of trustees walking by our garden sometimes and saying, look at all those weeds. Well, you know, it's a garden. So, you know, we're getting messages from the higher-ups that say, you need to make this thing look a little bit better for visitors. So, you know, we had a fence that was donated to us the first two years, and they essentially said, you better get that fence down and put up a new one, or maybe your garden's going to go here. So we had to build a whole new fence in the third year. So, you know, I think it's great sometimes to have that distance a little bit and to bring the farm to the campus. And so I think basically what we're saying is the visibility can come in very different ways. Marketing, having things like an audio walking tour and a bike to the farm potluck, and doing things like farmers markets on the campus. So I think, you know, you can be as creative as you want in many ways with the community garden farm.
It's interesting to hear you say that. Sometimes these aesthetics and sustainability really conflict in some of our farms, and we have to really push the envelope, the administration, to help them understand how these things are, and education, and teaching people why something looks like that. And it may not look like your perception of a clean garden, but here's what it does. Yeah. This is an insectary, this is a bluebird box with a predator control, or, you know, this is ugly, teaching people,
I might just add one thing to what Dan said. We have 135 deer per square mile at our campus, which is a ridiculous amount, but we have yet to, in 4 years, ever have one deer or one woodchuck in the garden because people are passing by it at all hours of the day and night.
And I'll say one more thing about aesthetics too. We have a permaculture project at the farm, and part of the idea is permaculture is working with, like, the, you know, natural native plants that are there, and having layers, not having things and crops, but having polycultures, as I'm sure a lot of you know. And so that, even one of the managers of the permaculture plot last season came back and was like, looks really weedy. And we had spent the whole summer thinking about, like, which weeds need to stay. It wasn't all about aesthetics. And so that's, I don't know, that it's an interesting educational tool, I think. And we also just got some money from the director of the Ag Experiment Station to improve the aesthetics of our street side, because there are, you know, cars driving by it all the time. So aesthetics is a big thing.
So along that same vein, in what the campus or the administration wants to see from your farm, how were you able to solicit support from the administration in the first place in order to start up your farm or garden, and how does your program interact today with the administration?
So startup, again, yeah, I wasn't around in 96 when it first started up, so a lot of this is just coming from research I was able to do recently. But again, there were students, faculty, and staff that all had a similar vision and all were part of the Sustainable Ag Working Group that I mentioned. And I think that the faculty that were involved were really active in working with their peers and working with the administration that some of them had relationships with for a while, to gain access to land and funding for students. And I think that can be a little overwhelming, although it's certainly possible for students to do by themselves. It's really useful while the idea is to have this autonomous space for students to run. It's useful at the beginning to have these alliances with faculty. And the faculty that we've worked with this whole time have no interest in taking autonomy away from students. They want to lend their resources and support to helping us. So that's really great. Recently, our relationship with the administration has changed a little bit. The staff member that we used to work with, she left to work on her own farm. We now have someone who came in her place, but only half of that position's time is dedicated to the farm. The other half is dedicated to other responsibilities. And so when the staff member left last year, we were very concerned about what was going to happen because her role was very much to sort of handle dealing with the administration and dealing with budgets and stuff for us, and we couldn't be sustainable, we couldn't continue if we didn't have someone sort of playing that role for us. When she left, she kind of organized us meeting with these higher-ups in the administration, and they came to our silly potlucks, and we thought they were really scary people, and they ended up being really quirky and funny, and now we have actual relationships with them, and now when they're thinking about, where can their money go, maybe they think of Dylan Hill. So I think that just kind of trying to forget about fear of approaching administrators, especially at big universities where, for me, I know that there's a lot of mystery surrounding them. Kind of trying to get away from that fear can really help in having personal relationships.
I think by virtue of being a small liberal arts college, perhaps we have more access to the administrators at Dickinson College, and I feel as though the aura of fear doesn't necessarily permeate between students and administrators at Dickinson. We actually work very actively to invite administrators to the events that we host either at the farm or here at the college. Last night, the president of the college was the person that introduced our keynote, I feel like we have wonderful allies within the administration. They get it, I'm very, very grateful for that. When we proposed the idea of transitioning the garden to the farm venue, there was no convincing. It was proposing the idea, and they're like, yeah, let's do it. That's a no-brainer kind of thing. So that's been wonderful for us. We work very actively with admissions as well, having tour guides available when there are prospective student days. There are options for prospective students and their families to come out to the farm, and we accommodate that as much as possible. It's sure it's hard. We need to harvest for our CSA for the farmer's market, and there's a tour that's supposed to start at 9:30, and we're really stinking busy. But we try to come up with innovative ideas, like a self-guided walking tour. We have a podcast that a student developed that people can plug into and walk around the farm. And then we have signage pointing to where we are at that particular time if people want to come and find us. So trying to accommodate the needs of the administration because, every student that comes to Dickinson because of the farm, that's money for the college. And so there's this mutual relationship between the farm and other programs on campus, trying to be the hostesses with the mostesses in an effort to recruit interest here. I will say that the trustees came out to the college farm last year. We had a trustee event, and we had a farm-style meal and evening affair, and it was a hit, and I highly suggest that. It's a great way to bring that awareness to those who are financially and heartfully invested in our institution. And they kept saying, let's do this again. And everyone was like, oh, God, maybe not. But it took a lot of work to get the farm in a place where we felt people would feel comfortable. But even then, it was rustic. And so it was a really nice introduction from the white linen sheets that they typically get here to rural down-home experience of what other opportunities are at Dickinson.
It's great to have a dean of the college that has to have your ribs. Your pork ribs. So the food thing is a great connector, and those things are great. I report to an administrator in my position, and so that gives me a little more access, I think, than some programs to the Presidential Advisory Council. But I don't always, I can't always accomplish what I need to that way. Sometimes, you know, things don't get communicated in the way that I would, you know, not necessarily getting the kind of advocacy on that council for projects I'm trying to accomplish. You know, just Thursday morning, I was putting my presentation together, and I had taken some pictures of our dairy barn built in 1925, which we put a lot of work into to put it back together and repair it. And now all we need is a roof. So I went in there after it rained, and I took pictures of the rock, you know, just was in there with my iPhone, took some shots, and I sent them an email, and I said, gentlemen, you know, if we wait on this, it's going to cost a lot of money. When you do this, it's an icon for our thing. And the president fired back and said, great, I'll take it out of my presidential discretionary fund. And I stepped on some toes doing that. I really did. The business manager came back and, you know, whoa, my boss, you know, but I've been asking my boss, give me the money, I need a roof. It didn't happen. So sometimes, you know, you have to step out there and do some things because, you know, in the end, what's important is that we get a roof on this barn and get it done. But it can be, you know, dangerous territory sometimes when you get into the politics of this stuff. But when you're open and transparent and you know, and your motives are good, then I think there's a lot to be accomplished. Drawing that presidential advisory committee in, tell them what we're doing, that's a huge deal, letting them know what you do. You're right. And it's a big job. It's something that I've actually feel like I've failed at over the years. I've done a pretty good job at farming, working with the students, but telling our story is something I haven't done because I just haven't had time. But I'm starting to do it more. You know, I think, 117-year-old farm school, everybody knows what we're doing. I'm right there, and they don't.
If you're a student looking to start a community garden here, I think the dirty little secret is with the administration is that you're the customer. The administration wants to please the customer. So making sure you just make that communication line, either email, call, or knock on the VP's door, I think they're going to listen to you. I think you'd be surprised at how accommodating that they are. But our first interaction, at least with the grant of the community garden, was through faculty. That was sort of our first avenue, and they sort of gave us the layout of the land. That was sort of our first meeting. And they encouraged us to go see the VP of operations, and she was ultimately, a lot of people said she was really scary, but ultimately she was the most gracious, sincere ally that we had. I had her cell phone number by the time I was a senior, and we had her audience, we had her ear at least once per semester once the garden started, and she was a huge advocate, not only from the administration end, but also with the Board of Trustees and the President's Cabinet, which includes faculty, staff, and administration. So I think just talking to people is very, very important, and remembering that you're the customer.
Mm-hmm. All right, this will be the last question before we open the panel up to questions from the audience. So how easy is it to get the food that's grown on your garden or your farm to the dining services? Is your cafeteria independently run, or is it contracted? And how does this impact the food sold to the cafeteria?
So it's, first of all, we don't really sell a lot or in this year any of our produce to Cornell Dining. Dillman Hill is a very small facility, and Cornell Dining is a very big facility, and they have a lot of red tape and a lot of bureaucracy goes into working out. They have relationships with other people who give them food, and sort of fitting us in when we could give them, like, even if we wanted to give them like 30 pounds of squash a week, like, that's not, they're operating on such a huge scale that it's not really possible. So we, rather than trying, than further pursuing a relationship with Cornell Dining, We have a really good relationship with a cafe on campus that is just really devoted towards buying locally sourced food, and just, you know, there's not a lot of places on campus where you can get like really good sound food. And so we work with that cafe, and that's like a really great relationship, also educationally for the managers to have the experience of, you know, marketing and working with cafe and writing invoices and stuff like that. Aside from the cafe, we sell at markets on campus. And in terms of getting our food from the farm to campus, we have a really cute little bike cart that we use and bike it back and forth. So, you know, luckily we're close enough that we can do that and look pretty stylish while we're doing it too. So extra points there. And we just kind of struck up a relationship with a new burrito place that opened in College Town, which is just where a lot of bars and restaurants are. The guy who's running it just graduated from Ithaca College, which is just next to Cornell. And he's using, you know, locally sourced or ingredients. And he bought, like, a bunch, I think the rest of our hot peppers from us. So that's a new relationship, and that's pretty exciting. So those are where our outlets are. And how we get our food around.
When we were at the Student Garden, the primary focus of our 3/4 acre plot of land was to sell at our farmer's market, and we also had a 7-member CSA that grew to 15-member CSA during the Student Garden days. However, we were able to establish a relationship with the dining hall. The dining hall said, whatever you have, we'll buy. So we're really lucky in that sense. You know, it's a much smaller campus than Cornell, and we're lucky to have dining service managers and directors who are receptive to the idea of buying food from our, you know, our Student Garden program. As we structured the college farm, around the premise of raising food for the dining hall. That's our primary focus here. Last year, I'm not going to talk about this year, this was a very challenging year to grow food in, but last year we actually were able to supply the college with 60% of the ingredients that they need that we raise on our farm. So I should probably specify that. We grow about 20 different crops for the dining hall. Of those 20 different crops, 60% of those crops came from us during the growing season. And the deal that was struck with the dining hall is, you know, since day one, we've been transitioning towards certified organic certification, and we are now currently certified organic, but the deal is that we will never charge the certified organic price of any crop that we sell to them because we don't want to affect their budget in any negative way, because as you know, certified organic crops cost significantly more, you know, for some than non-organically grown crops. And so where that relationship is really important is we're not charging them that price, but we're their first customer. They buy from us first, and that is, you know, written. We did a blood agreement on that because we're busting our butts out there, and to find out that they may have purchased zucchini that we had in the field from somebody else is like, it's like a stab in the heart, because we're all working really hard to do this. Dickinson is actually independently run. They're not a contracted dining services, so that makes them very much able to buy from us, to buy from other local farmers. You know, we're not the only local resource that they purchase from, and being an independently run dining services has really enabled them to do that.
The independent dining thing is really very cool. We had that up until the 80s. We're a Sodexo account now, and we're one of the accounts that Sodexo likes to feature as for sustainability initiatives. Both the College Garden and the College Farm send food to the cafeteria. They do a lot of salad greens and things like this. There is the challenge of seasonality, and that the biggest part of the growing season is not when students are there, one, to eat it or to do the work. So we've talked a lot about food preservation and really come to the conclusion that a lot of food preservation is really not all that practical. So we take the approach of hoop houses and season extension. And Sodexo has actually funded those. They also funded a walk-in freezer for my program, which is about $12,000. This allows us to keep meat stored. When I started doing this, you know, I'd say, hey, we need beef, and I'd go lasso a cow in the pasture and put her on a trailer. I hated that. I'd never have to do that again. I'd be happy. So now, you know, we do it and we store it and have it there, and if they need meat, they place an order. We do about 10,000 pounds of meat there every year. All of their ground beef for dishes, hamburger patties for hamburgers, breakfast sausage patties. This year I started doing bulk Italian sausage for their lasagnas, and they do pork shoulders and hams for barbecue. And what we do, our model is we take out the higher end cuts that we don't have enough anyway to feed our campus, our population, and sell those retail for a lot of money, and then sell them the trim, more utility cuts for a lot less money. Essentially, I guess you would call it a loss. So we actually move some dollars around. They only pay about $1 a pound for ground beef that I retail at the cheapest at $6 a pound, grass-fed beef. And then the college supplements that by moving some dollars around so that my account still looks like, reflects what my farm program would look like if I wasn't doing that. But, you know, it's something the college has a huge commitment to, local foods. And we're re-upping our contract right now, so it's been interesting to see the whole landscape of food service. We've interviewed Bon Appetit, Chartwell's, and Compass, to learn. And so it'll be interesting to see what, in the end, the cost looks like, the end cost to the student, when we have more local food.
Our dining hall is independently run, and the first thing that we started off a relationship with them in our first growing season, and they wanted produce by invoice basis. And so each week I would say what we had to offer, the dining services, and I would write out the invoice. And they gave, our price was between organic and the conventional market price. They were very gracious, but it was at such a small amount. We're not talking, Warren Wilson, Dickinson type inventory. So they were doing it more for marketing purposes, I would say, initially. And then in the second year, we warmed them up to the idea of just getting shares, being CSA members. And so they bought 2 shares from us, and it took a little while to educate them as to why we were just like putting boxes down, in their cutting vegetable areas. And they're like, well, what are we gonna do with this? I was like, well, this is a share. This is how a CSA works. And so they finally, they get it now. And so they still operate on that basis with the community garden.
Yeah, I do want to say one more thing that's important to us about marketing and where we sell our produce and stuff. We get a lot of support from the university, like free compost, and we don't pay for our water, things like that. And Ithaca and the greater community has a really thriving small farming community. People who are doing really cool, innovative stuff, and it's their full-time job. So wherever we sell, whether we're selling to students on campus or whether we are selling to Maxeo's, that burrito guy was talking about, we keep our prices higher than what other farmers are growing in the region, so as not to undercut them, because this is just, it's educational and just fun for us. For them, it's, it's their living. So I would encourage any other student farmers to try to think about that model when you're selling.
All right, thank you. Now we will open up the discussion to the audience. If you have a question, please raise your hand. Stand up.
I'm really happy to hear the distinction made between production and education, because I think it really helps clarify the goals of student farms and student gardens. I'm curious, you started to talk a little bit about Cornell's addressing the economics of having a farm and not wanting to undercut local producers. I'm curious about your experiences with reactions from faculty. I've, in particular, working with faculty in international business and management or economics here, some people have been somewhat critical and skeptical about the farm as economics and giving the students perhaps the impression that we're participating on an equal footing in the free market, when in reality there are subsidies, grants, all sorts of, the Dickinson Farm, as you said, Jen, was given, the land was given to us, which allows us to do what we do. I'd be curious to hear you talk a little bit more about what you see as the economics of what you do, if you have any experience in talking about that with faculty, and where you see the problems, where you see the advantages, and where it's, I think, a further opportunity for education. Does that make sense as a question?
Yeah. So I have a different view about competing in the marketplace. A lot of the farmers that succeed because they were given land by their families and because they have access to the same kind of grants, the same kind of government programs that we participate in. And in many ways, I feel like our program in particular, we started the grass-fed beef market in Asheville. Now there's dozens of producers. Many of them came through my program. So we don't necessarily compete like Jamie Ager and Hickory Nut Gap Farm. They've eclipsed our sales now. They were one of our first beef marketers in our program. And so they have all the restaurant business. Well, I don't really want to do restaurant business because I don't want to have students running trucks around and making deliveries to chefs and doing that. It's just not our model. So ours is bulk beef, and we've sort of carved out that niche in the marketplace. But, you know, I think there's also economic arguments that, you know, different farms competing are adding new product into the marketplace actually just diversify and strengthen the entire marketplace overall. Plus, we have to remember that our farm programs also do outreach. We do a lot of things for the community, too. So, you know, I've heard other people talk about that philosophy of competing out there, and I have that different viewpoint about it. As far as production and learning, just to sort of follow up on that, and I heard Josh Slotnick talking about this in his talk, that from our perspective, the production is education in our work program. We have to work hard at making sure that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, but in general, we're teaching students things that are alien to a liberal arts program, oftentimes, or threatening to the culture of a liberal arts program, but for us, are historically appropriate. So it just adds more diversity, but it does create issues sometimes in communication.
There's another question. Sorry. Do you have suggestions on grant sources for starting out?
Sure, I'll start that. I'm sure people have ideas. So we do a lot of grant writing at the Dickinson College Farm, and I was mentioning to people yesterday that a lot of the infrastructure that we have at the farm, like the greenhouses, the tractors, the manure spreader, a lot of our solar arrays were all grant funded. And I think that really want to, you know, ditto what Chase just said, that the grants that we're applying for are not specific just to Dickinson College or just to Warren Wilson. They're appropriate for private farmers, public farmers, community gardens, you name it. So it's just something that I personally have been tasked by the institution to figure out how to do. And I'm the one writing the grants, no one's writing for me. So I just want to make that clear. So NRCS is a wonderful granting opportunity right now. That's a Natural Resource Conservation Service. They're doing a lot of work right now with sustainable and organic farms. Their history is more conventionally oriented, but there is a new shift in their focus, and they're trying to educate their staff on how to work with organic and sustainable farms. And there are a lot of funds out there for implementing conservation practices, which could translate into biodiversity, tree plantings. They have a high tunnel grant that I think will be coming through again. I've heard murmurs of that. And IPM projects and integrated pest management, I mean, everything that would be applicable on an organic farm. And we actually got a substantial grant through NRCS, and we're implementing a bunch of conservation practices through those funds. Our whole compost initiative came through a DEP composting infrastructure grant. I do not know the status is on that funding source at this point in time, but the DEP has a huge focus on composting, and we benefited from applying for a grant. It was our second time applying for it. We didn't get it the first time, but we didn't throw up our hands and say, oh, never again. We tried again. You know, persistence is key, I think, in shaping your proposals based on the feedback you get from those who you're submitting the proposals to. We also have solicited for donations. BP Solar has been a huge donor to the solar programs and solar applications at the farm. So there's nothing wrong with going and knocking on doors and explaining who you are. A lot of hardware stores, even, you know, the big box stores of Home Depot and Lowe's, they actually have community enhancement grants available, which would be perfectly in line with startup needs of a garden or farm program. So those are some of the examples that I would share. I would also tell you that through the Bureau of Forestry, we just got an agroforestry grant. We're going to be writing an agroforestry plan and implementing that plan on the college farm, and that's a new push within the Bureau of Forestry. It's more geared toward the Chesapeake Bay region because of impacts that all of us are having north of here on the Chesapeake Bay. So integrating those issues on a farm and garden are also pretty important. And then lastly, I know that there's a lot of funding out there for urban agriculture. Most of the funding sources nowadays are geared towards urban agriculture. So if you're within an urban environment, there's a lot of money out there, definitely.
I'm curious what institution you're coming from and where you're at with your garden farm program.
So I'm at Shippensburg University, and you know our whole teaching supplies budget has been cut, and so I'm very doubtful that we're going to get any funds to start a garden. And we don't have funds to hire a lot of students to take care of the garden. So
we have time for one more question.
If there's no questions,
did you have a question?
I think that it's a unique challenge at a college or university that, you know, you have these really passionate students and then they leave. And I guess I'm just kind of wondering how you have dealt with that issue, if there's been certain years that, you know, it's harder because you can't find enough students, or so I guess what kind of problems has that created for you and how do you overcome that?
Continuity has been a big issue for us that we've talked about a lot, because, you know, we're all, since its conception, it's been basically all student run, with staff support, but basically all student run. So to kind of troubleshoot that, every year the market garden managers write a farm report, just explaining everything that happened in the season, finances, budget summaries, and then making recommendations for the next season. In addition, there are manager trainings, so managers from the past season will train new managers. And how we find new market garden managers is through applications. We have an application process. Applications go out like before winter break, and then we have a governing structure that meets and makes decisions about the managers for the next season. So at least with the market garden, it seems like continuity is pretty good. We try not to take on projects that will kind of get left to the wayside. Like, we'd love to have livestock, but it would be kind of irresponsible, like having a dog when you know you're not going to be home. Like, we just don't know if there are always going to be people who are going to be really into taking care of the chickens. So there are some projects that we have to say no to. There's a beekeeping project. We used to have bees at the farm. Students lost interest. And now there's just a lot of equipment. But there's a student group that has just approached us. So, you know, we're rethinking that, thinking that there could be ways to do that with continuity in mind. The research projects that we have at the farm are also a continuity issue because students have research ideas that they want to see happen at the farm. But then we have a lot of sort of half-baked research projects lying around. We don't want that to happen. But at the same time, research brings in faculty, which do bring in continuity to the farm because faculty are there for a long time. So I guess as far as research goes, it's just we have an application going out for that as well now, making sure that the student has certain things already thought out, like where they're going to get funding, who they're working with, if the scope of their project is really manageable, if it's just too big. And because if it's a good project, then research is a really good way, I think, to secure continuity and because of faculty involvement. So those are a few things that we've done.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a distinct challenge when I was a senior and realized that, you know, our main core of people were going to be leaving in about 9 months. And so setting up a formal structure within your organization is very important, making sure that there is, you know, action teams so you can get a diverse interest in your organization. So you have a grant subcommittee, you have a marketing team, you have a production team, and I think that's helpful for bringing in various kinds of volunteers for your organization. But we also in our business plan had plans for a federal work study position for two co-managers in the future, which did happen following my graduation. The two new co-managers went after that money for federal work study. It was within our plan, and so that's been helpful for continuity. Additionally, I started a sustainability major. I guess it's been 2 years now, Dr. Foster?
Yeah, we're in through our first full year now.
Yeah, and so having students as part of that major, there's also concentration for sustainable agriculture. So in that concentration, they're required to do a research project or an independent study. So it's helpful from that academic end as well for continuity. I think there's, you know, again, there's many different ways in which you can look at continuity, but I think ultimately having an administrator that's at least guiding the vision and the initiative is helpful for the future. We could probably have that discussion after this is over, but yeah.
All right, please join me in thanking Elizabeth.